Chapter 4 is where we'll begin this evening. So good to see everybody tonight. Thank you. Am I not on, Randy? Am I good now? There we go. All right. It's good to see everybody on this hot September evening. Thank you so much to everyone who helped scatter the seed in reference for our sermon this morning. Last week, we, of course, talked about how the parable of the sower really isn't so much about sowing as it is scattering. And this morning, what we saw was seed that was scattered. And there's already a couple of studies that I think are going to follow up from the efforts from this morning. And so thank you so much to everyone who was a part of that and helped scatter the seed to people you know, people in the community, and who knows how far that seed will go. This morning we talked about faith in God. And we went to Matthew chapter 14 and looked at the story of Jesus walking on the water to see that is an allegory of Jesus coming to earth to save man. Just as Jesus left heaven to come to the storms of earth, Christ left the mountain to come to this earth, and we likewise need to put our faith in Him. What I want to do tonight is go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and look at another common idea related to faith and entitle the sermon, Not by Sight. The question I want to pose tonight is this: what does it mean to walk by faith? It tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 7, we walk by faith, not by sight. That is one of the most famous cross-stitched passages anywhere in the Bible, right? Joshua 24:15, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's probably number one. Number two is Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And number three would probably be, for we walk by faith, not by sight. It's a great sentiment. But what does that actually mean in the context to walk by faith? It's a deep principle that I think Paul is getting at in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And I really want us to consider, what does it mean to walk by faith, not by sight? Within the context of 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and 5, Paul is discussing his ministry in light of the gospel. We oftentimes think of 2 Timothy as Paul's most personal book, and the various invitations that he gives at the end of 2 Timothy are very personal. But really, Paul's most personal book is the book of 2 Corinthians. Paul takes his heart and lays it on the line in the book of 2 Corinthians. He explains his motivation for ministry. He explains his purpose for preaching. He explains his reason for being, really, within this book. And what we're going to find in this context is really a distinction between the outer and inner self. So let's begin our reading. Verse 1 through 6 are going to talk about truth versus cunning. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word, but by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, which is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves and your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Paul is explaining his motivation for ministry in this text. And really what Paul is doing is he's contrasting his motivation with the motivation of false teachers who were among the Corinthian brethren. You'll note verse 2. Paul's talking about himself there. We have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. What he's saying here is this: we have gotten rid of every bit of human cunningness, every bit of deceit, every underhanded, deceitful, cunning scheme we have done away with. That's really the tactic that was chief among the false teachers at Corinth, is they were using every aspect of lying, of deceit, of false ways in order to get money, is ultimately what it came down to. They were trying to use various ways to get themselves rich and boast up their own ego. That was their motivation for ministry. Sound anything like many preachers today? Of course. I mean, that has always been one of, if not the chief struggles for preachers, is do not become boastful, conceited, built up, egotistical, and self-influenced in your own teaching. That's what the false teachers were doing. And you'll notice Paul contrasts this in verse 2, but by open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. What is Paul doing? Paul essentially is opening himself up to everyone. He is not using deceitful, cunning ways. He is just telling the truth, and it's going to take root in the hearts of man. He's scattering the seed. Some did not accept it. Why? In their case, the god of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. So we need to understand this before we continue on. Here's what Paul's doing. Paul is contrasting his motivation and method of preaching with the motivation and method of preaching the false teachers. The false teachers' motivation was building up self. Their method was cunningness and deceit. Paul, on the other hand, his motivation was for the sake of the gospel of Christ, selflessness, and his method was one of truth. Two completely different mindsets, two completely different philosophies of preaching and teaching. Well, how then does this relate to faith? How does this relate to the inner and outer self? What Paul is going to do is explain in the following section how he keeps this mindset. If Paul is motivated by the selfless intent of the gospel, and his method is one of blatant truth, how has he maintained this mindset? How has he kept this ideology in his own preaching? Down to verse 7. We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. How does Paul keep his loving, selfless, truthful approach to preaching? He sees himself as he really is. You'll notice the imagery of verse 7. It's really weird to us. We have this treasure, that is the treasure of the gospel. We have the gospel in jars of clay. What in the world does that mean? We have this gospel in jars of clay. This is somewhat of an anachronism to us because jars of clay were very common in the first century. Really, to say that we have this treasure in jars of clay would be similar to us saying we have this gospel in a water bottle. So here you have this wonderful, great, awesome mystery. The great plan of salvation, the great scheme of redemption, the great story of Christ. God has given it in a water bottle. Water bottles are dispensable. They don't cost much. They're not frilly. It's about as cheap and dispensable of a thing as you can consider today. Why has God given the treasure of the gospel in a water bottle, in a jar of clay? Well, if you'll notice down into verse 11, we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. Paul is the jar of clay. Paul and his fellow apostles are the jars of clay. They're the water bottles. Paul's a water bottle, essentially, is what they're saying. is he's dispensable, he's disposable. Recycle it if you're environmentally conscious, but just throw it out. Nobody will miss it. Just toss it away. You still have this great treasure that is given. Why has God given the great gospel message in the container of a water bottle? To show the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. Here's the difference. Paul is preaching the great message of the gospel because the message is great. The false teachers, on the other hand, they are teaching because they are great. The reason that Paul keeps the proper motivation and method in his teaching is he sees himself and he sees the gospel as they both really are. Paul and his flesh are dispensable. The gospel is, its value is beyond anything we could ever comprehend. The false teachers, on the other hand, it's all about them. It's all about making themselves great. It's all about making themselves rich. It's all about making themselves just be great in the eyes of everyone around them. Paul sees himself as he really is. Disposable. And brethren, I would recommend, this is a very challenging text for me as a preacher, is 1 and 2 Timothy have many good encouraging words to evangelists, but I think 2 Corinthians 4 is a text that should be demanded of every single preacher. Because how often is it that evangelists get so boastful in their thinking and so arrogant in their lives that they become a stumbling block to the great power of the gospel message? And we don't see it just in the world, but even preachers among brethren who think that they are just going to become so great and well-known that they're just wonderful. No. I'm a water bottle. There will come a point that I'll pass away. The message of God is always going to stand. There's an extent to which I could be disposed of. The gospel's still going to be there. It's still good. God's power is greater than me. Well, Paul then continues this thought by recognizing he is a jar of clay by explaining then, if his motivation is not in his own greatness, but in the word, what then is his mindset? Down to verse 12. Death is at work in us, but life in you. Since we have the same spirit of faith, according to what has been written, I believed and so I spoke, we also believe and so we speak. Knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. It is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. What then is Paul's motivation? Paul's motivation is life. It is a spirit of faith. Paul is motivated to give life, to give spiritual life to all that he comes in contact with so that the gospel in its great reward may spread. Verse 15, it is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase in thanksgiving to the glory of God. So here's where Paul is. You can either preach from cunningness and deceit, or you can preach from truth. You can either preach from selfish ambition, or you can preach from selfless love. If you're going to preach from selfless love, you need to remember you're disposable, God is great, his message is what matters, and ultimately his message brings about life. Paul then brings this to a climax, in the following verses. Verse 16. This, I think, really is the heart of this whole section of 2 Corinthians. We do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are seen are eternal. How does Paul keep this mindset? He sees life as it really is. The inner self is being renewed. The outer self is wasting away. Verse 17, this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Verses 16 through 18 are some of the most challenging mindset passages anywhere in the Bible for me. Because what these passages tell us is, there is something greater beyond this life. There is something more meaningful beyond the here and now. This life that we love so much is passing away. This world is transient and it's going. But, verse 18, we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Also, just one note before we move on. Verse 17, this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. In my judgment, that is the most important passage in the Bible about the problem of evil and human suffering. The problem of evil and human suffering has been, throughout history, the chief reason that individuals have left belief in God and faithfulness to God. What we have to understand is suffering in this life is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory. If we only focus on the here and now, this life will overwhelm us. It is only when through the eyes of faith we see that there is something greater that we're going to be able to get through this life and go on. Down into chapter 5, what Paul's going to do then is he's going to contrast our earthly dwelling with the heavenly dwelling. Chapter 5, verse 1. We know that if this tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on the heavenly dwelling. If indeed by putting it on, we may be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened. Not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are from home in the body, we are not away from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for him, what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Now we get to our passage. We walk by faith, not by sight. Contextually, what does this mean? What this means is, preaching can either be by cunningness or truth. If it is by truth, it is recognizing my own disposability. I recognize my own disposability by seeing the greatness of the gospel. By seeing the greatness of the gospel, I see the life that it gives. By seeing the life that it gives, I then see the eternity that is going to come. And then, in view of this eternity, we walk by faith and not by sight. Verse 6, we are always of good courage. We know that while we are away at home, let me restart that sentence. We know that while we are at home in this body, we are away from the Lord. For we walk by faith and not by sight. I want you to note, verse 7 is not an imperative. It's a declarative. He's not demanding them to walk by faith and not by sight. That's how this passage is simply translated. Walk by faith, not by sight. That's not what he's saying at all. It's a declarative statement saying, yeah, we just do this. We walk by faith, not by sight. What then does this mean? We are of good courage, as we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. What then does it mean to walk by faith? I want us to contrast a few different ideas we have seen in this text. What does it mean to walk by faith versus sight? The one who walks by faith endures persecution for the gospel. The one who walks by sight only sees the persecution that they endure. The one who walks by faith sees that which is eternal. The one who walks by sight sees only the things that are transient. The one who walks by faith sees the true heavenly body that is being prepared. The one who walks by sight only sees the earthly dwelling that we have. What then does it mean to walk by faith? Walking by faith means living in light of eternity. That's really what this passage means. Is we are going to walk in light of the eternity that awaits us. That is a thought that scares me, quite honestly, as a human. I like things to be in control, to be able to be manageable and understandable. I like to be able to put ideas and put them in a neat little two-point box that's easily understood. Eternity's not like that. And at 27, I still have difficulty understanding this concept of eternity. But the one who walks by faith understands, even if this life progresses till the days, not a Melchizedek, who am I trying to think of, Kirby? Methuselah. Even if my life proceeds to the days of Methuselah, it's still nothing in light of the eternity that God's prepared. We walk by faith, not by sight. What does this look like then in practice? I want us to use one example with Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11. Over in Hebrews chapter 11, Abraham is given as much detail as anyone in Hebrews chapter 11, the great chapter of faith. And I want us to note how Abraham walks by faith and what his faith enables him to do. Hebrews 11 verse 8, "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he went to live in a land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose builder and designer is God." What did Abraham do? Abraham went. He went. Back in Genesis 12, whenever God told Abraham, "Leave your kin, leave your family, and go," he went. What did faith look like in the life of Peter? In the life of Peter, whenever he was in a boat, surrounded by a storm, and he sees an apparition on the water, Jesus says to him, "Come." He went. For Abraham, God told him, "Go." He went. For Peter, Jesus said, "Go, come." He went. Faith means we walk by faith and not by sight. How was Abraham able to do this? You know, you take Abraham. Abraham was 75 years old in Genesis 12. He had an extremely well-established life by that point. He was an extremely wealthy man who would have had all of his business neatly organized. And he would have had his life set in his country. I think we underestimate how great of a test of faith it was for Abraham to have to leave his country. He was a wealthy man who owned a lot and would have had to have left so much of it and his kin to go. How did he do this? Because he didn't walk by sight. A few verses later, Hebrews 11, 13. "These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking about the land to which they'd gone out, they would have had opportunity to return." But notice especially verse 16. "As it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared for them a city." How did they do it? Verse 13. "They saw these things, by faith greeted them from afar, and by faith acknowledged that they were strangers and aliens on earth. But then verse 16, they desired a better country." Ultimately, I think faith demands of us to understand there is something beyond this life. When we walk by sight, all that we see is the here and now. All that we see is the empirical, the tangible, the things in this life that we can experience. By faith, though, it demands us to understand there is a world beyond this world. There is a realm above this realm. There is a God above this creation. Those are the demands of faith. Too often in my life, I walk by sight. I focus just on the here and now. Brethren, this has been a blessed but busy year for us. And in building a house, for example, it's easy to get caught up on just the here and now. By faith, I need to look onward. Certainly eternity gives meaning to what we experience now. That's what the book of Ecclesiastes is all about. Ecclesiastes shows eternity does not take away from the meaning of life. Eternity gives greater meaning to the memories that we make in this life. Because God gives meaning to what we experience. God gives meaning to what we have. That's a whole other sermon that I'll save for another day. But eternity does not take away from this life. It gives true meaning to this life. The heavenly realm does not trump this realm. It gives fuller meaning to this realm. The land that is beyond does not take away from the meaning of this land. It gives true meaning to this land. How then do we need to go about this? Well, back in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, one of my these three verses, by the way, I know I sound like Colin Creevy here, but these are three of my favorite verses in all the Bible. Love these verses. In this case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel, the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. I'll just read that verse. It speaks for itself. Ultimately, why is it we walk by sight so often? It's ultimately a spiritual problem from Satan. Satan is the one who blinds us, who makes us walk in darkness to where we can't see. Satan is the one who blinds us, but God is the one who gives us light to see the true nature of this world, to see the true fabric of this reality, to see the true nature of this world. And that is one of eternity. True sight ultimately only comes whenever we walk by faith in the light of Christ. So what then does it mean to walk by faith, not by sight? Well, in the context of 2 Corinthians 4 and 5, here's what I think it means. Walking by faith means walking in light of eternity. That's really what it means to walk by faith. Get out your songbooks, please. C.S. Lewis, in one of his best works, The Great Divorce, and also in The Problem of Pain, he does this as well in The Problem of Pain, he recognizes in that work that the glory that we will experience in the realm beyond will shine back on this life and give true light and true meaning to this persecution, the pain, the agony that we went through in this realm. Even if our age is as old as Melchizedek, and every day of it is filled with suffering, our momentary light affliction is producing within us an eternal weight of glory beyond any that can compare. We need to stop getting so focused on the here and now and see the life that is beyond. That's the demand of faith. There's a land to which we can go after we die. There's a land that is eternal, that is infinite. And that's the land of heaven. Faith, of course, is the means by which we can get there. Faith is not only the means by which we see the great heavenly home of God, but faith is also the means by which we get to the great heavenly home of God. Ephesians 2:8, for by grace you've been saved through faith. It is through that faith that God then will provide the grace, the blood of Christ, the love of His Son, and ultimately the redemption that is found in Him so that we can be saved and get to that home one day. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, come forward while we stand and sing.